So we're picking up where we left off last week, and Louisa has been talking about the ways in which the Lord actually communicates with her. So in the next paragraph, we deal with intellectual dialogue. There are then the two ways that the soul seems to go out of the body. And in these two ways in which the soul goes out, God speaks to me. Now, going out of the body is an out-of-the-body experience. Louisa has it almost on a daily basis, and it is completely and totally unusual. I will try to explain it, she said, but I call it intellectual speaking or intellectual dialogue. So that is communication in the intellect direct. So as the soul has gone out of the body, finding herself before Jesus, she has no need for words. You see, in the spirit world, there's no need for words. Anyone who's ever had a near-death experience will tell you that once you go into the spirit world, as soon as you have a question in your head, it is answered. You get direct knowledge put infused into your intellect. That's what she experiences when she goes into an out-of-the-body experience, which tells you she is out in the spirit world. So she has no need of words in order to understand what the Lord wants to tell her. Nor does the soul need to speak in order to make herself understood. Speaking is a problem that we only need on the planet, on Earth. It's through the intellect, she said. Oh, how well we understand each other when we are together. And she will continuously tell you for many volumes that what she understood out there, she is not able to communicate when she comes back. And that is a problem that other mystics have had as well. From a light that comes from Jesus into my intellect. Now, you know from later volumes that that light is the divine will. So it's the Lord infusing directly into her. But it has been called a light by all other mystics and saints as well. Hence, the process is called enlightenment. So from a light that comes from Jesus into my intellect, I feel everything that my Jesus wants to make me understand being impressed within me. That's called infused knowledge. So write it down, will you? It's infused knowledge. So this way is very high and sublime. And the reason why you would say that is that there's no possibility of interference from earthly things or from your own human desires or emotions or anything else. It is pure and direct. So much so that human nature, my book says that nature, you have to say human nature, can hardly adapt itself to explain it with words. That's her problem when she comes back. It can barely give a few ideas. This way of Jesus making himself understood is extremely rapid. Now, I have 2 Corinthians 12 verses 1 to 4 beside that. Everything in the spirit world is rapid, is instant. Everything in the higher volumes Jesus calls the low world, that's on earth, everything is slow. And you can't even get through if you dial a number. So Jesus makes himself understood. It's extremely rapid. In one simple instant, one learns many sublime things more than by reading entire books. Now, that testimony has been given by other mystics as well, that you would learn in 1 minute what would take you 4 years to study. Oh, what a most ingenious teacher Jesus is. In one simple instant, he teaches so many things that it would take entire years for someone else, if he manages at all, because the terrestrial teacher does not have the power to draw the will of the disciple. Now, notice that. The terrestrial teacher can only deliver information to your intellect, but cannot get you to receive it. They can offer it, but they can't get you to receive it. They don't have the power to draw the will of the disciple or to infuse things into their minds. So you see all the time that you're dealing with infused knowledge. I just want to write that down. So it's infused knowledge, but not with Jesus. His sweetness, the loveliness of his gesture, the gentleness of his way of speaking are so great. And then he is so beautiful. Now, in all of her writings, she describes Jesus as the most beautiful. Now, beauty is, of course, completely misunderstood because of society out there and the way the television projects so-called beauty A person could be very plain according to the way the world describes them. Beauty is something from the interior radiating out. And so it's a much higher thing than just having nice cheekbones and everything on your face is just sort of in proper balance so that the people in the world are impressed. But it's amazing how people are attracted to a person whose inner being is radiated through their face. And they're actually very attracted to you. They mightn't want to call you beautiful, and yet it's the only word that is. Now, in Louise's writings, and you'll find it all over the place in the crucifixion of Jesus in the Hours of the Passion, that Jesus says to the Father, "I was the most beautiful of all." But of course, the whole radiant light of God's glory was shining out through him. So beauty is that interior thing shining out. And if the ladies of the world had that on top of the physical niceness of their faces, they would genuinely be beautiful. But by the same token, you can therefore, without distortion, say that a man is beautiful. We're not inclined to say that a man is beautiful. We'd say handsome. But when we say handsome, we're sort of saying it's something masculine, whereas we're not talking about something either male or female. We're talking about the soul radiating out through the body. So he is so beautiful, and Louisa never hesitates calling him beautiful, that as soon as the soul sees him, she feels so drawn that sometimes the speed with which she runs after Jesus is so great that almost without realizing it, she finds herself transformed into the beloved. That's the soul attracted by the presence of God. And the soul going out of itself into God is called ecstasy, in such a way that the soul is no longer capable of distinguishing her terrestrial being so much as she identified with the divine being. Now, that's John 14, 20 to 21. And it's called union with God. "You in me," Jesus said, "and I in you." Yeah. Who can tell what the soul feels in this state? It would take Jesus himself or a soul perfectly separated from the body, because in finding herself surrounded once again by the wall of this body and losing that light which before kept her submerged, the soul loses very much and remains obscured. Now, everybody who has ever gone out of the body, either in a near-death experience or in ecstasy, all say the same thing, that coming back into the body clouds everything. It's like you have been in an airplane above all the clouds and glorious sunshine, and then the thing descends to the ground and there's nothing, only rain and clouds, and it's terrible. And you say, this isn't the day I had up there. That's the only image I can give you of the problem that they have. So if she tries to say something, she can say it only very roughly. That's 1 Corinthians 2:9, that the things that the eye has seen and ear has heard and what God has prepared is not possible to actually put into words. To give an idea, I will say that I imagine one born blind who has never had the good, that is the privilege, of seeing what is contained in the universe, and so for a few minutes had the privilege of opening his eyes to the light and were able to see everything that is in the world. The sun, the heavens, the sea, the many cities, the many machines, the varieties of flowers and all the other things that are in the world. And who, after those few minutes of light, returned to the blindness of before. Now, could he describe distinctly everything that he had seen? The answer is no, because he has seen too much in such a short space of time. It didn't mean that he didn't see correctly, but he didn't see it for long enough. How could he describe distinctly everything he has seen? He could only give a rough outline and say a few things confusedly. Now, in volumes 1 to 4, that's what Louisa says all the time. "I can only tell you in a confused way." Now, something similar happens when the soul finds herself separated and then back in the body. I don't know whether I'm saying nonsense. How you would say that in our languages, I'm not sure if I'm making myself clear. But just as the poor blind one would remain with the sorrow of his lost sight, it is the same with the soul. She lives moaning and almost in a violent state, because the soul feels always violently drawn towards her highest good. Matthew 11:12. "The kingdom of God suffers violence, and the violent or the valiant take it by force." The attraction towards himself that Jesus leaves in the soul is so great that the soul would like to remain always attracted to her God. But this cannot be. And therefore she lives as if she lived in purgatory. Now, Luisa is not actually exaggerating there. Other saints have also testified that when they have gone out in ecstasy with the Lord, the pain of having to get on with everyday life, with all its pettiness and smallness and the sinfulness of everybody around you and all the rest of it, becomes almost unbearable. And the only language they can use is purgatory, meaning dire suffering. But they use purgatory because the word purgatory means you will see him again. If they said hell, then it means you won't see him again. So they're using the word correctly. I add that the soul has nothing to do with of her own in this state. In other words, it's the Lord that accomplishes this. Everything is the operation done by the Lord. Now, we come to number two, and she's going to talk about intellectual visions. Now, I try to explain the second way that Jesus has in speaking. That means in communicating. Finding herself outside of herself, we're in an out-of-the-body experience again. The soul sees the person of Jesus Christ. Now, that's the vision. For example, as a child or as the crucified or in some other posture. And the soul sees the Lord pronouncing words from his mouth and the soul answers from her mouth. In other words, there's real communication. Sometimes it happens, and this is the type of communication you're going to get in all the messages once we get to the ones that have dates on them. She actually reproduces the dialogue. Sometimes it happens that the soul begins to converse with Jesus, just as two intimate spouses would do. And that kind of dialogue you're going to get also as we go on. My book says the speaking of the Lord, the words of the Lord. The words of the Lord are, you'd have to put, very moderate. Just four or five words. And sometimes even just one word, very rarely it lengthens a little bit. Now, this is only in the introduction. When you get up to volume 20 and onwards, you can have four A4 pages as one message. So it's in the beginning. He starts off by giving her a word, a few words, a sentence and so on. And then gradually he gives her shorter, what we call the shorter messages. And then the messages get longer and longer and so on. In other words, the soul has to accommodate to the way the Lord is communicating with her. So, but in those very few words, how much light he introduces into the soul. Now, if you go to Genesis 1:3, you'll get an illustration of what you mean by the few words of the Lord. Let there be light. And then the person who put the text together said, and there was light. But he only had to say, let there be light. And in the miracles of Jesus, you sometimes hear him just simply saying, I want it. That's all. And if he wants it, that's it. It happens. But how much light there is that is introduced to the soul. Now, the light you see is the divine will, and it's God himself. 1 John 1:5, God is light. And so what she's really saying is a sea of light is in, the soul is enveloped in a sea of light. That's why she understands so much. I seem to see a little rivulet at first sight, but in looking more closely, instead of a rivulet, it's an immense sea. Such is one word said by Jesus. The immensity of light it leaves in the soul is such that by chewing it thoroughly. Now, notice the mixed metaphors she uses. You can't chew light, can you?
No.
Okay. But what are you to chew? It's the message of those words. Chewing it thoroughly, she discovers so many things sublime and profitable for her soul as to remain astonished. So many people after an experience of deep ecstasy, I mean, they just want to stay close to the Lord and in prayer for 3 or 4 days after it. They don't want communication with anything else because it's such a sublime experience. I believe that of all the learned united together, they would all remain confused and mute at one single word of Jesus. Isn't that fantastic? 1 Corinthians 1, 19 to 21. 1 Corinthians 1, 19 to 21. Now, this way, she says, is more suitable for human nature. In other words, us who are on the earth side of things. And it can be manifested easily because upon entering herself, the soul brings with her that which she has heard from the mouth of the Lord and she communicates it to the body. It is not so easy when it's through the intellect because then there is no way of actually communicating it to others. It's ideas and thoughts when it's in the intellect. Now, Louisa says, to me, I think that Jesus has this way of communicating in order to adapt himself to our human nature. Notice that communicating is a better word than the word speaking. Do you see it? Because the word speaking to us means a mouth has been used and physical words have come out of it. It's actual communication. It's not that he needs the word in order to make himself understood, but in this way the soul understands more easily and she can manifest it to the confessor. If she has heard words, it's much easier for her. In sum, Jesus acts like a most knowledgeable, wise and intelligent teacher who possesses all the sciences to the highest degree. Now, the word science, as it is used in these writings, is not the same as our society uses it. When we say science, we think of a very particular part of knowledge, like physics, chemistry, botany, zoology, and that kind of stuff. With the Lord, science, it's a translation of a word, and I unfortunately don't know the word in Italian, but it means knowledge with understanding. Wisdom, knowledge, understanding, counsel, fortitude, they're the gifts of the Lord. And when the Lord says something to you, he gives it to you with understanding. If you're in a class with a teacher, they can give you knowledge, but they mightn't be able to give you understanding. So he possesses all knowledge and understanding to the highest degree, naturally because he's the source of it, that no one can equal him. But since he finds himself in the midst of disciples who have not yet learned the first syllables of the alphabet, keeping all the other studies within himself, he teaches the ABC to his disciples. I think that's absolutely lovely. Mm-hmm. And my way of saying that is you don't teach trigonometry to a three-year-old. They wouldn't enter the primary school for you, would they? No. They would simply say it was gobbledygook. And it would be. They need to be an awful lot older than that to get it. So, oh, how good Jesus is. You notice this, the English is wrong there. How good is Jesus is not English. How good Jesus is English. He adapts himself to the learned and he speaks to them in a very high manner in such a way that in order to understand him, they have to study well what he tells them. And he adapts himself to the ignorant, pretending to be he himself a little bit ignorant. And he speaks in a low manner, in such a way that no one may remain on an empty stomach from a lesson from this divine teacher. In other words, Jesus adapts himself. All of you who have reared children have learned how to adapt yourself from cooing at a kid in a pram to communicating at much higher levels as they moved on. Well, it's the same thing. You adapt yourself to the age and the experience of the person. So the third way, I want you to put a little heading here. And the words I'm going to give you come from St. John of the Cross, substantial words. You should put it on your book. Number three, the third way is substantial words. The third way in which Jesus speaks to me or communicates with me is when in speaking he communicates to the very substance of the soul. It seems to me that just as when the Lord created the world, that with one word he created everything, so that you have John 1:1 and Genesis 1:1. Both of them say the same thing. In the beginning, God created. And in these writings, Jesus will tell you that every word of his is a creative word. But you see that in the Gospels anyway, that when Jesus said, go and wash in the pool of Siloam, the man said, I went and I washed and I saw. So it was a creative... Sorry. It was a creative word. That each word of the Lord is a creative word. For example, I want to give you an example of a substantial word. And I always illustrate with the person sitting beside me, so it's nothing wrong with her. If the Lord says to you directly in your interior, forgive, that's not just a command. He creates the ability in you to forgive. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. That's what you call a creative word. Mm-hmm. And it's also a substantial word. That word, forgive, will remain in you forever. It will never, ever change. And every time you remember it, the grace that was given to you is renewed. That's a substantial word. That needs to be explained because many people in charismatic prayer groups say they get a word from the Lord. Mm-hmm. And very often it's nothing whatsoever to do with substantial words. Nothing whatever. It's a human thing. And you can very easily forget. And I've often said to people, if they're in prayer groups, if at the end of the prayer group and you've been there for an hour and a half, that you don't remember what was said, no substantial words were used. Now do you get it? Because if a substantial word is used, you remember it forever. Now, I'm not putting down prayer groups. I still talk about messages that the Lord gave to a group of us up in Ben Burb in 1973. I can still hear them. I can still feel what the Lord was saying. And I know that it's going to happen. See, a substantial word stays. So all I'm trying to do is illustrate, if the thing doesn't stay, it's not a substantial word. It's actually that simple. And very often we're trying to help somebody and we're putting our own substance into it without realising. But if it's a substantial word, you know it's from outside of you and it has incredible power. So he communicates to the very substance of the soul, hence the word substantial. Do you see it? Mm-hmm. It seems to me that when the Lord created the world, at one word, things were created. In the same way, since his word is creative, in the very act in which he pronounces the word, he creates in the soul the very thing that he was saying. Now, that's exactly what I've said to you. Mm-hmm. Now, as for example, Jesus says to the soul, see how beautiful things are. But as much as your eye can flow over the earth and in heaven, you will never find a beauty similar to me. At these words of Jesus, the soul feels a certain something divine enter herself. Do you see the difference? Something divine has entered. The soul remains so very drawn towards this beauty. And at the same time, she loses attraction for the things of the earth that are not beautiful. So the substantial word actually makes a change inside of you. As beautiful and precious things may be on the earth, understood, they make no impression on the soul. That which remains fixed within her and almost transmuted into her is the beauty of Jesus. Of that beauty she thinks, with that beauty she feels invested, and she remains so enamoured that if the Lord did not operate another miracle, her heart would crack, she says. We say the heart breaks. I'm sure there's no difference between breaking and cracking. And the soul would breathe her last out of pure love for this beauty of Jesus. Now, all the mystics have said the same thing, that if you have a profound experience of God in ecstasy, the Lord has to withdraw himself, otherwise you will die. Because that's exactly the aim of your life, is to go out of yourself and into God. That's paradise. So if the Lord wants you to finish your life on the earth, he's got to withdraw. And that's where you're going to hear Louisa moan for 14 volumes at least, that she can't stand Jesus going away. The pain is just unbearable because she saw him so frequently and she saw him so completely as well. The soul would go out of herself, out of pure love, and fly into heaven and delight at the beauty of Jesus. I myself don't know whether I'm speaking nonsense. Now that means I don't know whether I'm communicating, but she is, isn't she? So, here we're at the substantial words again. In order to explain myself better about this substantial words of Jesus, instead of substantial, you can't have substantial speaking. You can have substantial words, okay? I will say something else. Jesus said, see how pure I am. In you also, I want to find purity in everything. Now, when I was growing up many moons ago, in Dublin, purity meant always sexual purity. In these writings, you're going to hear purity in a much, much wider context. If I give you a drink of water And there's a tiny, it's wonderful water, but there's a tiny bit of contamination in it. Then it's impure. If you listen to an orchestra and one of the instruments is slightly off, you say, "Oh, that's desperate." And that's impurity in sound. Do you see what I'm saying? Now, the impurity is that there's something spoiling something incredibly beautiful. Have you got it? Yeah. There's just tell her what page you're on.
Page 28.
There's something spoiling something incredibly beautiful. Now, if I come to sexual impurity, then you're talking about the incredible beauty that God has made in the human being, that we have no idea how magnificent the person is when the soul is in union with God. And as far as the Lord is concerned, if that is contaminated in some way, to him, it's horrific. Now, Louise is going to explain this as she goes along, as she comes into this understanding. And this is what you mean by that sin is horrifying. And the only way I can tell you is that if you have something magnificent and somebody blots it with a paint or something, it's utterly destroyed. Now, the entire painting isn't destroyed, but it is in a way, even though the bit of paint or whatever you threw onto it is spoiling one part of it, but it does spoil the whole thing. So purity is going to be a very important issue, particularly in the first four volumes where we're laying down foundations. But I like to just sort of widen it slightly in case we just look at it in too narrow a focus. So I want purity in everything. Now, I'm going to illustrate the everything. One of the things he's going to give an enormous amount of attention to is purity of intention. Can I give you an example of an impure intention? Now, I'm using impure deliberately so that you'll hear that this is wider than you were told. If I tell all of you that I'm going to fast tomorrow, you say, "Oh, isn't she great? She's doing something really holy," and all the rest of it. And then in the back of my mind, I say, "Well, she could use a few pounds as well." The very fact that I'm saying inside of myself that I could benefit from this fasting means it is an impure act. Just eat your meals, because you're neither going to lose weight nor are you going to lose anything else. You've lost everything. That's impure. And you'll find that one of the things that Jesus condemns most is hypocrisy. And when you read Matthew 15 and Matthew 23, you see him going after the scribes and Pharisees tooth and nail. Why? Because of the impurity of the way they were worshipping God. Now, can you hear impurity? They had the right clothes. They had the right job. They were doing the right actions, but they were serving themselves and making themselves very rich and very powerful, but they were not actually glorifying God. Now, that's impurity at a very deep level. Impurity in worship is a very serious matter. And it's not just in the gospel that this is introduced in the Bible. There's a lot about this in the Old Testament as well. Particularly, you'll find it in Psalm 50, where the Lord says in Psalm 50, "What are you doing standing in my presence when you are at home with adulterers and you accept thieves and you accept this, that and the other?" In other words, your so-called spiritual life is totally contaminated. It's completely impure. Get out of my sight. And the scriptures are very clear about the fact, Hebrews 12:14, nothing impure or unholy can enter the presence of God. Finito. Just won't. And in higher volumes, Jesus says that 9 out of 10 good people who die go to purgatory. Why? Because of impurities. If you go to a place that makes things in gold or silver or anything else, they will tell you that if the gold is impure, it loses an enormous amount of its value. So they have to purify it, absolutely. That's why the Bible talks about being purified like gold in the furnace. You know, so what we're actually talking about here is a major subject, not only in Louisa, but also in the Bible itself. All right? And the Lord is going to tell us that we need an enormous amount of purification in our lifetime. Because half the time you don't see the impurities that you have yourself in your motivation and all this kind of stuff. And we can have impurities in our desires and all the rest of it. At these words, the soul feels a divine purity enter into her. Now, a divine purity is something so high, so immaculate. You see, if you go to divine purity, you have to use the word immaculate. Did you hear it? That the person is completely changed. This purity is transmuted into herself and she arrives at living as if no longer in a body. In other words, she is spiritualized. And so with the other virtues. Oh, how desirable are these words of Jesus. As for myself, I would give anything that is on the earth if I could possess it and even possess even one of these words of Jesus. So number four, the fourth way in which Jesus communicates to me is when I find myself inside of myself in the natural state. She's no longer in ecstasy. This also happens in two ways. The first one is when, while being inside myself, recollected within the interior of my heart, without articulation of voice or sound to the ear or the body, Jesus speaks interiorly. Now, they're called interior locutions. And that's quite common with people living a spiritual life. It's not unusual at all when you're speaking to spiritual people that they will say, "The Lord said to me." And they may have, they'll use those words and they may not have heard them as distinct words, but yet the message has been communicated very clearly. It's actually quite common. The second is just the way we do it. In other words, there is words. And sometimes this happens when I am distracted or I'm speaking to other people, so she needs to have the words in her ears. But one of these words is enough to make me recollect myself if I'm distracted and to give me peace if I am disturbed. So what she's done there is a great service, and the priest began to realise that this needed to be explained because she was having such profound experience of God. With all the study I've done on this thing, I have come to the conclusion that it was the bishop who insisted on the priest asking her, because the church had actually got very, very interested in what was happening with this person. So that was an interlude, and now she continues from the story from a few pages back. "So I will continue where I left off," she said, "and this is how he did it. In the morning, I went to communion, and as soon as I received Jesus, I immediately said to him, 'My Lord, look at what a storm I find myself in. I should thank you, for you gave light to the confessor in giving me the obedience to suffer. But instead, my nature is so very affected that I myself remain confused at seeing myself so bad.'" Now, the word "so bad" there, she will use them in the early volumes. The Italian word is cattiva. And if you translate it into English, it's your naughty little thing. Because if she's bad in the sense of having sin, then forget about union with God, forget about divine will. You cannot have union with God or divine will if there's sin in your soul. Even venial sin, you can't have it. So when she says, "I'm so bad," she's looking at this divine purity and comparing the weakness of human nature with this divine purity. So, you know, there's just no comparison. So that's why she will use that expression. "However, this is nothing. You who want the sacrifice will also give me the strength." Now, do you know what she's talking about? I'm asking you a question. Do you know what she's talking about? So what you do to find out what she's talking about is go back a few pages before she was teaching you about how the Lord speaks to her. You go back a few pages. And was there, she was telling you a story. And then she interrupted it and gave you this teaching. And now she's continuing. So it's that story that she wants to tell you about. So let's go back. Unfortunately, my pages are half the size of yours. She was saying that she had told the priest that the Lord wanted her to be in bed for a very short time, about 40 days. Do you remember that? Yeah, because he wanted her to suffer. That was the thing. So she's picking up on that. All right. And she said, "I should thank you, for you gave light to the confessor in giving me the obedience to suffer." So the priest has told her it's okay to be a victim soul. "But instead, my nature is so very affected that I myself remain confused in seeing myself the way I am. However, all this is nothing. You who want the sacrifice will give me the strength. Now, that's the sacrifice to stay in bed. And she has no idea that she's going to be in that bed for 64 years. If she knew that, she just couldn't do it. And beside that, I want to give you Psalm 40, verses 6 to 8. Here I am, you want this sacrifice. So that's Psalm 40, verses 6 to 8. And Hebrews 10, verses 5 to 7. Again, speaking about the sacrifice. And that's the sacrifice of your own body. Now, if you don't think it was a sacrifice to sit in bed for 64 years, I think you don't know what we're talking about. I would have gone mad after a week. I don't know about you. So he tells her in higher volumes when she's sort of needing a bit of reassurance. He says, look, everybody will know that a person in the whole of their health cannot sit in a bed for all the years that you've sat in a bed. It has to be a miracle. It's one of the signs. It's one of the signs. And so if you look in a mirror, you see whatever you see, but you don't see what other people see. They see something different. So she can't see herself. But the strongest reason in me is that of having to remain so long without being able to receive you in the sacrament. Now, that means the Holy Eucharist. So Louisa is presuming that if she stays in bed, she won't have the Blessed Eucharist and she won't have Mass. That's because she's only at the beginning. They will, in fact, bring a little altar into her bedroom in the end and say Mass there. Who would be able to resist without you? Resist means put up with the sheer tedium of sitting in a bed, apparently doing nothing. Who will give me the strength? Where will I find a refreshment in my afflictions? And while saying this, I felt such pains in my heart because of this separation from Jesus in the Most Holy Eucharist that I cried my heart out. And then the Lord, compassionating is not a word that we use, sympathizing with my weakness, told me, do not fear, I myself will sustain your weakness. So that's Philippians 4:13. I can do all things in Christ who gives me the strength. You do not know what graces I have prepared for you. And even when she begins to get them, she just can't believe it. And this is why you fear so much. Am I not omnipotent? Psalm 89, 8, 1 John 4, 18. Psalm 89, 8, 1 John 4, 18. Will I not be able to make up for the privation of being able to receive me in the Holy Eucharist? Therefore, resign yourself, place yourself as though dead in my arms. That's Psalm 131. My soul is like a weaned child on its mother's lap. Offer yourself as you'd have to put in a voluntary victim to repair for the offences against me. So the Lord is asking her to be a voluntary victim soul and to make reparation for others, for sinners, and to spare human beings the deserved scourges. And as a pledge, I give you my word. Now, this is God speaking, okay? That I will not leave you even one day without coming to see you. That will not be found in any other biography of any other person on this planet. It's totally off the Richter scale. Up until now, you have come to me. From now on, I will come to you. Aren't you happy? Isn't that amazing? Totally amazing. So I want to give you a heading for the next section, and it's the graces that she received. He told her he was preparing great graces for her. So step one was I resigned myself to the holy will of God. That's the first stage. Without the resignation, we're going nowhere. And that resignation means that whatever it is that you're suffering from, that you adore the divine dispositions in your life. You have allowed this to happen to me, whether by your direct will or your permissive will. It doesn't matter. I'm not going to look at it. You've allowed this to happen to me. I adore and praise and accept and bless you for this. I enter into it. That's it. See, that's a completely different place to people at a much earlier stage in the spiritual life, where the moment they get any trouble, they run after people to pray with them to get out of it. It's totally different. You're in a much, much higher place. So the first step then is this surrender. And I was surprised by this state of sufferings. Now, who can tell the graces that the Lord began to give to me? It's impossible to tell you everything distinctly. That's your 1 Corinthians 2:9 again. I can't say it. I can only say something confusedly because she has explained that's how it is. But as much as I can, and in order to do holy obedience which wants it, I will say as much as it is possible for me. So the first thing is, I remember that from the very beginning of my being continuously bedridden, my lover Jesus would make himself seen very often, which he had not done in the past. Now notice she calls him my lover. It's no longer my Redeemer, my Saviour, my God, my whatever. It's my lover. It's completely different language. It's the language of the Song of Songs. And the language of the Song of Songs is all over Volume 1. From the beginning, he told me that he wanted me to take on a new way of life. Write DW beside that. And that was to live in the divine will. Now, she'll only realise that as she goes along. In order to dispose myself to that mystical marriage which he promised me. So she's going to have the mystical marriages and then she's going to be lifted up onto the level of divine will. He would say to me, "Beloved of my heart, I have put you in this state so that I might come more freely to converse with you. See, I have freed you of all external occupations." This is one of the things that's important for understanding Volume 1, to distinguish what is it that applies to Louisa alone and what applies to the rest of us. She was being asked to live in a bed, completely isolated from normal life because of the extraordinary calling that she had. You are not called to that. So for the extraordinary things that apply just to that situation, doesn't apply to you. So I have freed you of all external occupations so that not only your soul, but also your body might be at my disposal, because her body is going to go through all kinds of sufferings. And so that you might remain in continuous holocaust. Look at the word. Gosh. Holocaust before me. See, had I not drawn you into this bed, you would have had to carry out your family duties and submit yourself to other sacrifices, and I could not come as often and let you share the offences just as I received them. Now, what she's going to do, what the Lord's going to do with her, is as he receives offences from the earth, he wants her to mitigate them. It's absolutely extraordinary the way the Lord actually works. And when he tells us that he loves us, we very often misunderstand it, that he should love us in a lovey-dovey way, meaning I hug you and I kiss you and I blah, blah, blah. You know, it's not like that. Here's human beings creating hell for themselves on the earth, and he has somebody mitigating all of that so they won't actually get hell. And there's some possibility of recovery. That's infinite love. That's loving us beyond our ability to even understand what love is. And when you're reading this, you're not just hearing this extraordinary relationship between Louisa and Jesus, you're hearing this extraordinary relationship between Jesus and the human race. And if you just keep remembering what he said, what is said in the hour of the Passion in which Jesus is on the cross, "At any cost, I want to save them. At any cost, I want to save them." So he's going to bring Louisa into a position of, "At any cost, I want to save them," because he tells her that her life is to be a mirror of his in everything, which is totally extraordinary. "So you will share in these offences just as I received." That means daily. At most, I would have to wait for when you have fulfilled your duties. But of course, if you weren't in the bed, I'd have to wait until you were ready. Now, I don't know if you've read any of the writings of Vasula Rydén. Irish people call her Rydén for some reason or other. Rydén is her name. And the Lord has to wait until her family duties are finished. And then he says, "Now come." And that's what he's saying to Louisa. If you were still committed to family life and that kind of thing, I'd have to wait until your family duties were done. And then we could talk. but he doesn't have to do it here. But now, no, we are free. That is, you and I are free. And there's no one left who may bother us or interrupt our conversation. That's called solitude, S-O-L-I-T-U-D-E. And solitude means alone with the alone. That's what solitude is. From now on, my afflictions will be yours and yours will be mine. My sufferings will be yours and yours will be mine. My consolations will be yours and yours will be mine. This is the real victim soul. We will unite all things together and you will take an interest in my things as if they were your own, and so will I do with yours. Between the two of us, there will be no longer this is mine and this is yours. Isn't that fantastic? Let's hear John 14:21 again. You in me and I in you. Everything will be in common on both sides. I also have Matthew 6:33 there. So I'll give you a heading for the next paragraph, which is the Lord's desire for intimacy. Because that's what love is. God is love. And love always seeks union, doesn't it? And love always seeks intimacy. Do you know how I acted with you, he said, like a king when he wants to speak with his queen spouse, and she is with other ladies on other affairs. What does the king do? He takes her and brings her into his own room. You'd have to add the word O-W-N. They close the door and so that no one may go in and interrupt their conversation and hear their secrets. And so once they are alone, they communicate their consolations and their afflictions to each other. Now, if some imprudent person went to knock, shouting from behind the door, and did not leave them alone to enjoy their conversation, do you think the king would take that as an offence? That's the way I am with you, he said. And in the same way, I would be displeased if someone wanted to remove you from this state. Is that beautiful? Yeah. So the heading for the next section is the programme for this new relationship. Because there is a program, there's a way of life. He continued to tell me, from you I want perfect, that's 100%, conformity to my will. This is the plan. Now, perfect conformity means there will be none of your will. You won't have plans of your own. In such a way that your will may be undone in mine. Your will won't be operating. She will call this annihilation and all kinds of things. And I want absolute detachment from everything. Now, if you don't think that's a tall order, try detaching yourself from something you like. So much so that I want all that is of earth to be considered by you as dung and rot. That doesn't mean it is dung and rot, but you're to consider it as if it was. All you're being told is you give your full 100 attention to me. But that's all lovers ever want, is it? Do they want you to be distracted with other relationships? No, they don't. They go mad, don't they? So, and this because even though one were not attached to earthly things, just by having them around them and looking at them, they cast a shadow on celestial things. Now, good people need to look at that. I presume everybody in the room is good. That the very fact of being surrounded by all of this stuff actually does affect you. So I'm going to throw something out and I probably won't say it again. And that is, gradually, you've got to let go of the black box. It's doing terrible damage to everybody. There was a nun, I think it was in the 18th century, who got a vision. And all the church knew about her vision was that it was terribly important. But none of them understood it. And they said, we will keep the memory. And they wrote it down. And the vision was this. She said, I see a family, a father and mother and children sitting in front of a black box, and the black box is destroying them. And the only thing the church knew was something was going to be invented that would destroy family life. Find that interesting? Now, there are some useful things on it. But we just have to be very, very, very careful. Because that's what the Lord says. Even if you are detached, it can affect you. And it can affect you even just by putting a worldly kind of haze on things, and you lose the sharpness of the spirit. And that's very dangerous when you're really trying to get into divine will. So just by having them around them, they cast a shadow on celestial things, because all the stuff, even the news, I mean, the only thing I watch is the news. And even the news, is so contaminated, because it's totally contaminated with a worldly thinking that is completely contrary to the way the Lord wants us to think. But at the same time, you do need to know what's going on the planet. So that's casting a shadow over celestial things and prevent the fulfillment of that mystical marriage that I promised you. Even more, I want that just as I was poor, you would also imitate me in poverty. Now, there's nothing poorer than sitting in a bed and owning nothing. have no control over water or food or anything else coming to you. You must consider yourself in this bed as a poor little one, and she will refer to herself as a poor little one for the rest of the time. The poor are content with anything they have, and they first thank me and then their benefactors. Now, it's to be the same for you. So go along with everything that's given to you without asking for this and that. Whoops. Try it. And they'll give you the only dinners you don't like. And they'll offer you the only things you don't want and all the rest of it. And this will really test you. And that's how you will know. So if you write on your book, write no self will. That's what he's asking. No self will. And the motto you have to have once you begin this journey into divine will, the motto is as clear as daylight: not my will, but thine be done. And every time something crosses you, just try and get it out of you as soon as you can. Not my will. Even sometimes I just say it out loud so that I hear it. He doesn't need to hear it, I do. To make sure that I've adjusted myself, you know, that I'm not having a problem with something that I would have had a problem with before. Same for you, to go along with everything that's given to you without asking for this or that, which might be a hindrance to your mind. Notice he doesn't want a hindrance to your mind. What's going on in the world today is the contamination of the human brain, and they're trying to seduce the people's thinking into a way of thinking that's totally anti-God, anti-Christ. That's what's going on, and it's mind control they're trying to use through all these gadgets. You have no idea. They've managed very well with the iPhone to mind control millions of people. They're totally addicted to this gadget. Mm. Totally addicted. And unfortunately, they get addicted before they're 15. And as far as I'm concerned, they have very little chance unless somebody takes it out of their hands. But with holy indifference, without thinking of whether it may be good or bad, comply with the will of others. Ooh. Now, if you try that one, you'll be well exercised. Louisa said, this cost me very much at the beginning, and we all say, ditto. Especially because of the obediences that the confessor would give me. I don't know why he wanted me to take quinine. See, the doctors think there's something wrong with her. And for some unknown reason, they gave her quinine. And I deliberately say some unknown reason, because they tried quinine on us in Africa to try and counteract some of the stuff. Quinine is not an easy thing to take and as side effects. But on someone who was eating as little as she was, it must have been devastating. And I was given the obedience that as many times as I would throw up, because her stomach wouldn't take it. So many times was that I take food again. Now, quinine would whet the appetite. That might be the only good thing it would do. And sometimes I would feel quite a bit hungry. I would take food, and immediately after taking it, and at times in the very act of taking it, I would be forced to bring it back up because of the continuous retching. And I would remain with the same hunger as before. The word poor, which Jesus had spoken to me, would not allow me to dare to ask for anything. And I myself would feel ashamed to ask, thinking to myself, what will the family say? She has just vomited and now she wants to eat. Now, what she is beginning to learn is the long fast of being a victim soul. And she describes it so simply. Somebody else would say it to you in highfalutin words, that it doesn't take the pain away, that fasting costs. But she's speaking in a very childlike way, and she says, you know, I was hungry. Of course you're hungry if you're fasting. So I would remain content with being able to offer something to my dear Jesus, and the thing she's offering is hunger. However, this didn't last a very long time, only 4 months. Can you imagine being practically starving for 4 months? One day the Lord told me, repeat to him the request for the obedience not to take quinine, because quinine was very bad for her, and not to take food so many times, for I will give him light. That's enlightenment. So the confessor came and I told him, and he said to me, so as not to show uniqueness, oh dear, people use the most crazy motivations. We don't want you to be unique. Everybody's unique. You may be like somebody else, but no one person has been duplicated. The Lord has this extraordinary variety on the planet. We don't want you to be unique. From now on, I want you to take food only once a day. And he suspended the quinine also. Well, at least she was only going to have to vomit once a day. In this way, I remained more quiet and hunger went away. Now, once they would stop interfering, the Lord actually supplied her needs. Okay. But the vomiting did not cease. That one time in which I would take food, I was forced to bring it up. Sometimes the Lord told me to ask for the obedience not to eat, but the confessor has never given me this obedience. He would say to me, it doesn't matter if you throw it up, it's another mortification. Wonderful, isn't it? But I would say to Jesus, and he would tell me, I want you to ask the question, but with holy indifference, I want you to go along with whatever the obedience says to you. The obedience is the priest, you see. And she said, that's what I did. And for about 40 days, this went on. That's more than 6 weeks. I don't know how you would react to that. I'd be gone mad already, would you? Which I had taken as much from those words that the Lord had said for a certain given time. She thought she was only going to be in bed for about 6 weeks. And which I had related to the confessor in this way. The sufferings continued to surprise me every day. Surprise me means she didn't bring it on. And he was forced to come every day. The confessor began to give me the obedience to no longer be in that state. Now, you see, the priest is getting a bit fed up coming every day to just make a sign of blessing over this woman, and then she loosens up. So he began to give me the obedience to no longer be in that state, and he added that if I fell into sufferings, he would come no more. Now, that's a threat. Now, here's the priest not realising that he's up against the Lord. He's not really up against Louisa. And so the next paragraph, I want you to put a heading in it, the cost of being in bed. Because you have to know it really cost her. On my part, I felt absolutely ready to do the obedience. My nature especially wanted to be freed from being in bed continuously. In other words, it was so boring. It was so tedious. Because as beautiful as it was always bed. It's the way she puts it. Having to be subjected to everyone, even in the most repugnant and necessary things of nature. Like if she has to be in bed, she's going to have to be washed in bed and everything, you know. And being forced to tell them to others, it's a true sacrifice. So nature, that is her human nature, did its office of wanting to complain and felt all consoled in receiving this obedience. While my soul was ready to do the obedience and ready to remain in bed if the Lord wanted it so, because I had begun to experience how good he had been to me, and that true resignation can change the nature of things from bitter to sweet. Would you underline that in green, white and gold? That is definitely for you and me. It's from her experience, but it's given for all of us. That if we are resigned to the Lord, something that is bitter as an experience, the Lord will change it just by your resignation alone, he turns bitter into sweet. So when he gave me the obedience to no longer to stay in bed, I began to resist. So now she's told to get out of bed. And I said to the Lord, what can I do? I can no longer stay, for obedience doesn't want it. That means the priest doesn't want it. If you want, you give enlightenment to the confessor, and then I will be ready to do whatever you want. So not my will, but thine. Can't you see it? And I spent one entire night clashing with the Lord. Do you remember Jacob and the angel? Uh-huh. When he would come, I would say to him, my dear Jesus, have patience, do not come, for obedience does not permit that you make me share in your sufferings. Up until morning, I won. There's Jacob and the angel, and then the angel wins the battle, doesn't he? I felt I was inside of myself and free of sufferings when in one instant the Lord came and drew me so much to himself that I couldn't resist him. I lost consciousness, that means go into ecstasy, and I found myself together with him, but so clasped to him, such that much opposition as I made, I could not detach myself from Jesus. Being with Jesus, I felt all annihilated, and I felt a certain blushing for the many reproaches that I had made during the night. And I said to him, holy spouse, forgive me, it's the confessor that wants it this way. And he told me, don't worry, don't fear. When it is because of obedience, I don't get offended. I love the expression, do you? In other words, if it's somebody else ordering it, but if it's your own thing, that's different. And he said, come to me. Today is the new year. I want to give you a present. Isn't that interesting? This morning was, in fact, the new year, she says. So he drew his most pure lips to mine and poured a most sweet milk in. Now, in these recollections, she speaks about receiving a milk from the Lord. It's called milk because it appears to be white. Many of the mystics say the same thing, but I don't understand it. I don't know what is actually going on, so I can't explain it. And the only decent thing for a teacher to do is to admit their ignorance as well. Another thing she gets every now and then is what she calls a liqueur, and it's bitter. And somehow the Lord is communicating something, and all I can say to you is, watch what happens when she gets the milk, and watch what happens when she gets the liqueur, and then you yourself can come to a conclusion. In other words, I'm trying to guide you to get from the text itself what is happening. So he kissed me, he took a ring from within his side, and he said to me, today I want to show you the ring I have prepared for you for when I espouse you. That means when I marry you. Then he told me, tell the confessor that it is my will that you continue to stay in bed. And as a sign that it is me, tell him that there is a war between Italy and Africa, and if he gives you the obedience to continue to suffer, I will not do anything on either side. They will reconcile. So here's the Lord now giving a strong indication to the priest that it is in fact himself that wants Louisa to stay in bed. So he has to give the priest a piece of information that he knows, and he knows that Louisa doesn't know. In the very act of saying these words you spoke, I felt surrounded by sufferings as by a garment, and I was unable to free myself by myself. I thought to myself, oh, what will the confessor say? But it was no longer in my power. That milk, watch this now, that Jesus had poured into me produced in me such love for him that I felt languor. Now, you find that in the Song of Songs, chapter 3, it's around verse 4 or further on, where the bride says, feed me with apples because I am sick with love. So the milk is feeding divine love into her. Why it comes, the reason why I can't explain it is that I've never come across an explanation as to why it's this. Thought has just come to me this minute, so it's obviously somebody trying to help me, to help you. And that is... yeah, I would never have thought of it. What the Lord seems to be saying is, look at a mother and child. The very first thing she does is to feed the child with milk. She's giving her own substance. And you've just read that Louisa said, I was filled with so much love. My substance, he said, is love. So there you have it from himself. Simply because I admitted the truth. And he does that sometimes in the classes as well. He just gives it to me directly. So she feels this incredible love actually given to her. So that I felt languor, she said. And I felt such satiety and sweetness. You see, and the child does as well after sucking from the mother's breast. That after the confessor came and I came round from that state and the family brought me food, I felt so full that the food would not even go down. In other words, this infilling of... Let me write this down in case I forget. Because if he gives you something, you shouldn't forget it. She has been filled so much by the Lord that her body has no needs. Now, that's going to be her reality for 64 years, that he will actually sustain her completely. And she gets it here for the first time. So after the confessor came, I was so full that the food wouldn't go down. But in order to do the obedience which wanted it so, I took a little bit and I was immediately forced to bring it up. But mixed with that sweet milk that Jesus had given me, so for the first time, the priest has evidence that when she says she received milk from the Lord, that it is actually real. Now, I want you to write down, just beside that, evidence for the priest. And look how kind the Lord is. You can't expect the priest to understand something he hasn't seen before. But she said she received milk and that she's full with it. And now the food comes back with the milk as well. Jesus almost jokingly told me, "So what I gave you isn't enough?" John 6:35. "Are you not content yet?" I blushed all over, but immediately I said to him, "What can I do? It's obedience." I love the way she says that. It's not my problem, it's the priest. So when the confessor came, he began to get upset, telling me that I was disobedient, or he would say to me, "This is an illness. If it were something from God, he would have made you obey." In other words, the priest is following what they have known from the past about ordinary situations. He would expect that the Lord would force her to obey, but the Lord is trying to get the priest to open up to something completely new. "Therefore, instead of calling the confessor, you should call the doctors." When he finished speaking, I told him everything that the Lord had said to me, which I mentioned above. And he told me that it was true that there was a war between Africa and Italy. "We'll see if nothing happens," he says. And so he was persuaded in letting me continue to suffer. She had to give him that piece of information to try and tell him that there's something real going on. So one day after about 4 months, one of the things that impresses me hugely is how long her trials go on. The confessor came and told me that news had arrived about the war between Africa and Italy and that without causing any damage to each other, they had reconciled. So since the sign was accurate, the prophecy was complete, the confessor was persuaded and he let me stay there in peace. In other words, he had received a true prophecy. So just right beside it, this is a true prophecy. Now, while she's having a lot of difficulty with the priests and that kind of thing, at the same time, you have got to have a lot of compassion for the priests. They've never been in this situation before. How are they to know that this isn't some kind of a mental illness? So the heading for the next paragraph is daily visits from the Lord. He had promised her he would come, didn't he? "My sweet Jesus would do nothing but dispose me to that mystical marriage which he had promised me. And when I was in that state, he would make himself seen 3 or 4 times a day. Absolutely unprecedented." Talk about uniqueness. The priest didn't want her to be unique. Just as he pleased. "And sometimes it was a continuous coming and going." In other words, she had heaven on earth. He seemed to be a sweetheart who couldn't be without his spouse. This is how Jesus was with me. "And sometimes he reached the point of telling me, 'You see, I love you so much that I cannot be without coming.'" There's a lovely level in which you can just look at this as a real, genuine love relationship. But on the other hand, if you realise she's the only person on the planet who loves him like this, no wonder he comes. He can't believe it. Somebody on the planet loves him like this. And he's going to take her to heaven more than once and say to the saints, look at the way she loves me. Nobody else loves me like this. Nobody at all. Not even them when they were on the earth loved him like this. He said, I feel almost restless thinking that you are there suffering for me and you're all alone. And this is why I've come, to see if you need something. It's a real lover situation, isn't it? And while he was saying this, he himself would lift my head. He would place his arm around my neck and hug me. That's Song of Songs 2:6. His left arm under my head and his right arm embracing me. Song of Songs 2:6. And while holding me like that, he would kiss me. And if it were summertime and it was hot, he would send a refreshing breath from his mouth. And he would take something in his hand and he would fan me, imagine. And then he would ask me, how are you feeling? Don't you feel better? I would say to him, being with you in whatever way one feels grand, thanks. Other times then, if he saw me very weak because of my continuously being in those suffering, because that's why he said he would come very frequently if she would continue in them. Especially if the confessor was coming at night, my lover Jesus would come. And in seeing me in that state of extreme weakness to the point that at times I felt I was dying, he would draw near me and from his mouth he would pour milk into mine. There you have it again. But I want to give you Song of Songs 2:4. Or he would place me close to his side and from there I would suckle torrents of sweetness. That's Psalm 36, verse 8. You drink from the torrents of his delight. So if the psalm says you could drink from the torrents of his delight, it means that from ancient times, people knew that if you came close to the Lord, it is the delights of heaven that you actually taste. And the awful thing is that the world has deceived millions of people into thinking that very low things and ephemeral things will give you delight, and it doesn't. It doesn't delight them at all. So she's already experiencing the torrents of sweetness and delight and of strength. Now that strength is physical, mental, emotional and spiritual. It's the whole thing. And he would say to me, I really want to be your everything. Now that's lover language, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And also your nourishment, not only for the soul, but also for the body. That means that he himself wants to be her sustainer. And she says, who can tell me what I experienced both in the soul and in the body from these graces that Jesus would give me? If I wanted to tell them, it would be too long. I remember that sometimes when he would not come quickly, I would lament to him saying, oh, please, oh, holy spouse, how could you make me wait so long? She probably waited about 10 minutes. The rest of his wait a lifetime. I could not resist anymore. I felt I was dying without you. And while saying this, the pain I felt was such that I would cry. And he would sympathize with me. He would dry my tears. He would kiss me. He would hug me. And he would say, I don't want you to cry. Isaiah 25, verse 8. Isaiah 25, verse 8. Revelation 7, 17. That's where he will dry our tears forever. And Revelation 22:4, again the Lord says he will dry our tears. In other words, that sorrow will end. See, I am with you now. Tell me what you want. I would say to him, I want nothing but you. That's Deuteronomy 6:4. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, and all your mind, and all your being. And only then, I want nothing but you, and only then will I stop crying when you promise me that you will not make me wait for so long. And he would say to me, yes, yes, I'll make you content. So I'm going to stop there for tonight. It's wonderful stuff, isn't it? Yes.